Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 07-7101, Henry Navron Pons. Mr. Bergman for the respondent, Mr. Crimmins for the amicus curiae.
Morning. May it please the court. I haven't been down here. I think the last time I was down here, Judge Robb and Judge Bazelon was still up around here. So it's a pleasure being back after all this time. With my limited time here, let me make an observation. I was reading my brief last night, and I was not happy, and I thought that there was some connection that I wanted to make to articulate to the court really what I was driving at with this Castigar argument that I had made. And I think I can articulate it this way, and I should have probably put it in my brief, and it's one of these last-minute light bulb affairs. And basically what I wanted to say was that I look at the Castigar thing, and I'm conceptualizing this, as sort of a fruit of the poisonous tree. Now, I don't mean in the classic Nardone or Wang Sung type of fruit that is, we're not dealing with an exclusionary rule, but the concept being that back in 2000, when the government started chasing Mr. Pons around, and you know, DEA, FBI, taxes, everything, when they went after him in the year 2000, and he was already the subject of an investigation at that point in time for criminal contempt, that clearly, by this court's opinion, Judge Brown, I think you were on the panel that wrote the opinion in Mr. Pond's case. I think what they did was the process got tainted. The process clearly got tainted way before any of the elements that ended up bringing us here today.
That's what puzzles me, and that's the question I was going to ask you. How was his criminal contempt conviction for in Maryland at all influenced by the act of production in the D.C. case? I mean, as I understand the facts, in the Maryland case, he submits a document to the court after a sentencing hearing, and he's standing in court and refuses to disclose to the judge information the judge has asked. Now, what is the connection between that and the act of production that occurred in the D.C. case?
Because they actually didn't know. The document, as I understand it, you can't tell from the Judge Williams' opinion is probably the district court's opinion sets forth the facts. The Fourth Circuit, it was nothing because all the argument was basically it was a two-page summary unreported opinion, and that only dealt with the issue of an accountant testifying. So none of the underlying issues where everyone went down to the Fourth Circuit, but it appears to me that what the initial problem that he had with Judge Williams or in the sentence, you know, in Harris's sentencing phase was a sin of omission at that time, not commission. He basically didn't speak up.
Are you saying that somehow from the act of production that they learned of his misconduct?
Well, I don't think they knew. I don't think the government, Judge Griffith, I don't think the government really had a handle on this until they started their really full-scale investigation in the year 2000. I think that was after Harris, you know, said to them, listen, by the way, this guy's got my 91 Mercedes. He took it for a fee. It was even his title in my mother's name, but I don't think there's any dispute.
So what's your best, if you can crystallize it, what's your best Castigar argument? You're saying that you have a sense.
That the government.
You've got to be better than that. I mean, what's your best?
The best argument I can make is that basically that somewhere the government couldn't prosecute him for criminal contempt at that point in time unless they had his production, and that was the Castigar issue. He gave them a ton of documents. They really didn't know what they had at that time because when they issued a subpoena, initially, if you remember, he said, I'm going to assert my Fifth Amendment rights. They gave Mack the production immunity under 602, And then they ran off and they went and searched. They went. They searched Harris's cell. They sent the DEA out to his house.
On the remand from our previous decision, what happened? He pled
out to two misdemeanors, which were the, I think they were 703 violations. They were both the failure to file taxes. That's what the record shows. Mm-hmm. Now, I'll be candid with you. I'm very familiar with that issue because I've handled some of the cases in D.C. that involved taxes. And the D.C. Court of Appeals has ruled that comes out of Shorter and Kerr. And my case that I handled, the Casolino case, and I'd be glad to give you the citation for that, all dealt with tax evasion issues. And the D.C. Court of Appeals indicated clearly that these type of violations, and especially a 703 violation, are not moral turpitude per se issues. You can still get found to have committed moral turpitude if they felt these were intentional, willful acts. But those required hearings.
Yeah, but the disciplinary rules itself, Rule 3E, permits us to look to, regardless of the Castigar issue, regardless of the anything be overturned, permits us to look to the misconduct itself, right?
Every disciplinary jurisdiction that I'm familiar with and that I've done work in, that is a standard rule because you are the ultimate arbiter.
There's no question here that he misrepresented his knowledge, that he didn't tell the judge about the
mistake. That's correct. Yeah. Now, why he didn't tell the judge, of course, he testified that he didn't think he had to. I think that's the bottom line. I think he basically says, well, I didn't think I had to make that disclosure. This was my fee. I didn't realize this was part of the forfeited assets issue that the government was looking for. So that was what the whole debate, I think, on that issue was. Every court, you have the inherent power in your regulatory position, you know, for the over discipline, that you don't even need a rule to tell you that you have the right to look at conduct. These are conduct-driven proceedings. The disciplinary process really can be totally independent. Judge Griffith, you're right. Even of any criminal conviction, he didn't have to be convicted of anything at all. He could still be subject to the same discipline we're talking about today merely by what conduct he exercised in the disclosure issue. But basically, that the timing is critical.
And
the
government very helpful to you.
I know it's a hard thing, but the government didn't know. The government really didn't know what was going on until 2000.
I guess the difficulty that I'm having with your argument, Harris, you concede in your brief that you can't relitigate the criminal contempt, mm-hmm. In a disciplinary proceeding. And yet, isn't that what you're arguing?
No, I can't. I know it sounds kind of, listen, I'm trying to get something for him because somewhere in there, it just, you know, it's the sense that somehow, you know, the government's conduct is almost on a, you know, a parallel with his, or maybe misconduct is parallel with his. Yet he, because he didn't, or his attorney or whoever was representing him in the Fourth Circuit didn't raise the Castigar issue that fortunately the attorney here raised with respect to his tax. They're all the same. It was all the same act. The Maryland criminal contempt, the tax evasion and the fraud.
That's
here.
What I was saying. You said but and didn't finish it. I mean, you've acknowledged the Castigar issue really is, at one level, irrelevant, right?
Listen, I can only do the best with what I have.
Okay, I understand.
I guess what the problem is, basically, is that if you look at the government's conduct, I think that you would have to determine, and all I ask for is for a remand, you would have to determine whether the government reached out so far in 2000, which is when they initiated their investigation, and then in 2001, by the time even D.C. got really fully geared up too. And frankly, they chased poor Mr. Pons, to be candid with you.
Sort of. Bottom line, we should disbar the government lawyers.
No, but we should think about maybe giving him a hearing to go, you know, plow through some of that stuff that was never plowed through before, because Mr. Pons did not really ever step up to the bat. Frankly, in looking at the disciplinary history of this case, he really didn't do anything. I mean, he let everything go by almost by default. He's still letting it go by default, even though he has an attorney representing him in D.C. They never filed an answer to the board's the current report from December. So, you know, I mean, that was the problem. He never fought the disciplinary process. I've got about a minute left. Let me save it for a little rebuttal, if I might, unless the court has any further questions.
No, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Judge Brown, and may it please the court. My name is Brendan Crimmins, and I am appearing here today as court-appointed amicus curiae. Two courts, the District Court for the District of Maryland and the Court of Appeals of Maryland, disbarred Mr. Pons following his April 2002 conviction of criminal contempt. After consideration of those proceedings, this court's Committee on Admissions and Grievances recommended that this court also disbar Mr. Pons. The court can adopt the committee's recommendation on either of two independent grounds. First, reciprocal discipline is appropriate here. Under Rule 4 of this court's Rules of Disciplinary Enforcement, when another court disciplines a lawyer admitted to practice in this court ordinarily imposes the identical discipline. Imposing reciprocal discipline promotes public confidence in the legal profession. There are four limited exceptions to reciprocal discipline. Mr. Pons addresses only one of those exceptions.
If he's right on the Castigar claim, why isn't it a grave injustice?
For several reasons. First of all, and we take no position on whether there was a violation of the witness immunity statute in the Maryland proceeding, but assuming arguendo that there was, that would not go to his guilt or innocence of the criminal contempt charge. And it would not call into question the reliability of the factual findings of the judge who heard Mr. Pons' trial, nor would it call into question that judge's legal conclusions that Mr. Pons' conduct constituted criminal contempt. In addition, Rule 3D of this court's Rules of Disciplinary Enforcement provides that a judgment of conviction is conclusive evidence of the commission of a crime. As far as we know, Mr. Pons has taken no efforts to seek to vacate his Maryland criminal contempt conviction. Under those circumstances, our position is that the court should treat the conviction as valid for purposes of this proceeding. The problem with the remand option that Mr. Pons contends for is that the government would not be a party to the proceedings on remand. So the committee would be poorly positioned to determine whether there was a violation of the witness immunity statute in the Maryland proceeding, and if so, whether that violation was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, Mr. Pons has had opportunities through briefing and argument in this court to present arguments regarding the relevance of this court's decision in United States versus Pons. And he has not explained in any detail what showing he would make to the committee that would justify declining to impose reciprocal discipline. In addition, the committee already had an opportunity to consider this court's decision in Pons, which was issued several months before the committee's report. And the D.C. Court of Appeals Board on Professional Responsibility has reconsidered Mr. Pons' disciplinary case in light of this court's decision in U.S. versus Pons. And that board has adhered to its recommendation that reciprocal disbarment is appropriate in this case. If this court agrees with the committee that no exception to reciprocal discipline applies in this case, then the inquiry ends here.
Do you agree with counsel's point that at least as regards the D.C. tax evasion, that's not a crime of moral turpitude?
The two misdemeanors that Mr. Pons pleaded guilty to on remand from this court's decision in U.S. versus Pons, we have not understood our role to take a position on whether those convictions would constitute a crime of moral turpitude. If the Maryland criminal contempt conviction were not relevant or vacated. But I think it's important to note that the only relevance of the moral turpitude determination is that under District of Columbia law, when a lawyer commits an offense involving moral turpitude, disbarment is automatic. But even if this court need not adopt or even address the moral turpitude issue in order to adopt the committee's recommendation. First, reciprocal disbarment is appropriate regardless of whether the court agrees that this would be a crime of moral turpitude under D.C. law. And apart from the moral turpitude issue, the American Bar Association's standards for imposing lawyer sanctions provide that when a lawyer engages in serious criminal conduct, an element of which is the intentional interference with the administration of justice, that disbarment is warranted. In addition, the D.C. Board on Professional Responsibility has concluded that Mr. Pons's conduct would warrant disbarment under District of Columbia law, independent of the moral turpitude statute. Now, that was in the context of considering reciprocal discipline, but the board opined that disbarment would be among the range of sanctions appropriate for Mr. Pons's conduct. If the court has no further questions, we submit that the court should adopt the committee's recommendation.
Thank you, Mr. Crimmins. I know you were appointed by the court, and we appreciate your assistance.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Edification while I have a few seconds left, the case that I was talking about, the Casolino case, which was my case, but that discusses the shorter and the Kerr issues where these type of tax cases, evasion cases, are not crimes moral turpitude per se. And the citation is 697 Atlantic 2nd at 11, and that's a 1997 case, in which my client, by the way, was disbarred for tax evasion. But in any event, it's my case, so I'm really thoroughly familiar with the issue. And if I might just observe something in my brief time here, I'm just rolling that rock up, and I just can't quite get it to the top of the hill, and it keeps coming back on me. But I'm hoping that Castlegar will keep it up there a little longer before it all rolls back down on us. I just think that somewhere he has a right to, if it's a conduct-driven process, to get deeper into his conduct and the government's conduct, and let some committee decide. The end result may end up being the same, but at least he'll have had an opportunity to present an argument that was never, ever presented really before any disciplinary agency before. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bergman.